Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Today I have the exciting conclusion of my deep interview with Temple University PhD Dr. David Jacobs for you. Now, Dr. Jacobs has been the leading pioneer on the UFO abduction phenomena for the past three decades, but his latest research on human-alien hybrids, or hubrids, may shock and surprise you. Now, in part one, Dr. Jacobs discussed the developments in our understanding of the alien abduction phenomena as a culture over the last half century. In this special episode, he'll reveal astonishing details of a multi-layered program to integrate thousands of hybrids into modern society and how the UFO abduction syndrome has grown up. Prepare for some startling conclusions. Here we go. Dr. David Jacobs, the UFO threat and hybrid infiltration.
Most of the stuff, I think, is relatively new. I use the word hybrid. They're taking the place, I think, of aliens because they need a larger workforce. Eventually, what happens with abductees is they take these hybrids on, or hybrids, as I call them, because they're living here, and then they teach them as much as the hybrids want, and then the hybrids go away, and a new one comes along.
You know, when we think of the advent of UFO research right after World War II, with the wave of sightings, the Roswell incident, and the realization that there was something else out there buzzing our skies, we can see that it stirred a great curiosity inside of us as a society. We suddenly found out we had atom bombs that could destroy our world, and so we became aware that there was no possibility of going back to the simple life ever again. Then suddenly, we started hearing about UFO abductions happening all over the world. The reaction from the powers that be was to keep it all secret and to find a way for special interests to gain a huge advantage by utilizing the advanced technology. But what would an average person's life look like after encountering alien visitors? Let's go ask Dr. David Jacobs.
Dark Journalist will go there. The deepest issues, the hardest stories, the biggest secrets. The truth is never easy. With top guests, like former Assistant Housing Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz.
Catherine, who is really behind this media censorship?
Internet feeds go through satellites. Who controls the satellites? It's the Pentagon.
Legendary investigator Graham Hancock.
Graham, this cataclysm must have destroyed an advanced culture in our ancient past.
It truly was an extinction-level event. It was accompanied by massive animal extinctions. It was accompanied by huge and unexplained sea level rises, and then a sudden plunge of global temperatures.
Best-selling author Jim Mars.
Jim, don't these elite corporate owners need us around to buy their GMO food? Why would they want to depopulate?
Because they are eugenicists and they believe that they need to purify the human race. If that sounds like the Nazis, that's exactly what it is.
Coast to Coast AM investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe.
Linda, how are we going to scale that wall of UFO secrecy?
Humans themselves are bypassing, are beginning to dismiss all of the policies of denial and lies.
Dark Journalists will go there. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount available for just $39 for one full year. You'll not only receive access to the complete audio archives to stream or download at your convenience, you'll also get exclusive subscriber-only content and Dark Journalist event discounts. Sign up for our free newsletter to stay updated on the latest shows. Dark Journalist. Let's get the real story in 2016.
You know, we need dark journalists, so just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, hello everyone. First off, I want to thank you for your overwhelming response to part one. I promised you an exciting follow-up here to our first interview with Dr. David Jacobs, who's a PhD at Temple University in Philadelphia. And this is going to be a fascinating and even deeper look at his work on alien abductions. Of course, he pioneered this work over three decades ago. But this hybrid stage of alien research is completely new, and we're going to find out more about what's going on here and how this UFO abduction syndrome is changing. I want to remind you to sign up for our newsletter at darkjournalist.com so you don't miss any of the groundbreaking episodes we have coming up. David, thank you for joining me for part two of our deep discussion on the alien presence. Now, in part one, we touched upon this program that you've described for integrating these alien hybrids into our society. and we're going to go much further into detail on that. First, I wanted to get your opinion on why the official story hasn't changed much on UFOs in the past 50 years. You know, even after we've made these extraordinary discoveries, you know, recently discovering new galaxies, new planets, why are they so stuck in this old paradigm?
Let me put it this way. Years ago, there was an argument called the rare earth argument. It suggested that because of the bizarre things that happened to Earth before life evolved, smacking into Earth by the Mars or the Moon or whatever it was, I mean, creating the Moon and whatever, and knocking the Earth off its tilt to 7.5 degrees, and then the dinosaurs came, and then the destruction of the dinosaurs through a comet or whatever, a meteor. All these odd things happened, which allowed for us to evolve. You know, without those things happening, we might not have evolved at all. But they're so unlikely that it's possible we're the only life out there, you know, in the universe. Well, that's a stupid argument. Mm-hmm. Simple as that. Just dumb. It's based on lack of knowledge, on profound lack of knowledge. Now that we found all these planets, and we found, and scientists used to say, well, they can't get here from there, you know, even if there is life out there, traveling even at the speed of light, blah, 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 blah. You can't get here from there, yeah, blah, blah, blah. That's also a stupid argument. Then people say, well, there's no planets around us, or, you know, another stupid argument.
All right.
The key question is, are they here or not? It doesn't matter how they got here, and it doesn't matter where they come from. Who cares? Are they here or not? That's the only thing that matters.
Okay.
It's the same thing with flying here. How did they get here? It doesn't matter how they got here. It doesn't matter where they're from. The only thing that matters is, are they here or not? Now, scientists are beginning to say, well, wormholes and multiverses and, you know, oh, maybe they can get here, you know, maybe they can get here. And but there's no evidence that they're actually here. That's because they have no evidence that they look at through the abduction and UFO phenomenon, which is already a century old.
Yes, absolutely. Well, there's no objectivity going on in the scientific community around this. And one of the issues they seem to really get stuck on is the abduction phenomena more than anything else. So, you know, that's just completely outside their comfort zone.
Right.
Now, when you look at this hybrid program of placing these hybrids in society, do you see it as more of an infiltration than an integration?
I do.
Okay.
Unless, of course, those two words are the same.
So, again, it comes down to secrecy.
Secrecy is still the major component. And I will be writing a book about I have two more books to write. One is How to Do Hypnosis for the Abductees.
Nice.
And the other one, and
we need a training manual for that.
This will be a manual. It will be a training manual. I figure that the audience for that kind of a book is in the tens and tens. So I'll self-publish, you know.
Well, I can name a couple of people who would want that right off the bat.
There's two out of the tens and tens.
Well, let's go further into these abduction cases. Now, one of the things I find compelling in your work is that you follow the lives of these hybrids trying to become human by using the abductee basically as a teacher. Now, what is it they're trying to learn, and what is behind this new kind of behavioral effort?
Here's the problem. When I was born, there were 2.4 billion people on Earth. Mm-hmm. Now, in this year, there's 7.3 or 4 billion people on Earth. That's from 2 to 7 in my lifetime. That is a population explosion. That means that the abductees are expanding as well. That keeps up with the population.
Uh-huh.
That also means, and here's where we have no knowledge, here's the backstory, that because of the huge population explosion, there has to be more UFOs, the literal UFO airplane, so to speak.
Right.
And more aliens to do this work to keep up with the number of abductees who are exploding also.
Okay.
That means that there's got to be this backstory that we don't know, the creation of gray aliens and the creation of more UFOs in terms of their actual structures, you know, their physical beings. And the insectolens, as I call them, insect aliens, who are running the show. And so what you're seeing here is an explosion of population and also an explosion of the number of UFOs and the number of abductees. But apparently it's not exploding enough. So what we see now and haven't seen so much in the past, although it could have been in the past as well, is abductees who are being taught to do alien duties.
Uh-huh.
Being taught to work on other abductees. Being taught to control other abductees. And I have this long section with Betsy and this poor guy who thinks he's going to jump off a mountaintop or a cliff or whatever it is, you know, in a room next to her. And I did not actually tell the whole story, the backstory of this. This was a whole long training thing leading up to this. Having other abductees sit behind a wall and then have her with her mind command one of the abductees to stand up and walk around the wall and face her. That's what it started out with. Other abductees being trained to do things like that, even being trained to bring forward sexual response like gray aliens do when in egg-taking situations for women.
Mm-hmm.
And they're taking the place, I think, of aliens because they need a larger workforce.
Ah.
That's my guess. That's my guess.
So they're enlisting these abductees to do part of the work of this program for them.
Right. That's what I think is happening. I don't know what's happening with whether it's happening with all abductees or not. I must say, I don't know that. You have to work with abductees for a long time after they begin to say that. But most of the stuff I think is relatively new.
It sounds like it.
It's like this new stuff I began to hear in 2003, where somebody says to me, this guy said to me, which is in the book, in the fourth session we had, this is a guy who was about 50 years old and a businessman, he said he remembered that he had a friend, and he remembered his friend's name, Eric. And Eric was not only just a friend, he was his best friend. He'd forgotten all about him, but he says, well, I've had several best friends in my life, and I haven't forgotten them, you know. And they've been to other countries together. They've had dinner together. They've had long talks together, and on and on and on and on. And he doesn't know Eric's last name, and he doesn't know whether Eric works or not, doesn't know whether Eric is married or not, doesn't know where Eric lives, doesn't know anything at all about Eric, but he's his best friend, which, of course, is totally nutty.
Right.
That cannot be possible. You're telling me something that only a nutty person would say. And so we did a session on the first time he met him or whatever and this and that and all the rest of that stuff. And it's very interesting. That was not evidence. You got to wait for somebody else to come along and say the same thing who is not aware of this testimony. Soon somebody else came along and said something similar. Then somebody else came along and somebody else and somebody else and somebody else and then somebody else. And then Karen Morgan, who I've been working with since 1987, never said anything like that to me before. And I realized that something was different now.
Yeah.
Now, I can't tell whether something should have been different years ago, and maybe if there was a number of other researchers, they would have found it years ago. But certainly for the people I was working with, this was new for me. And my favorite question in the world up until 2003 was, do you think that they're walking among us, that they're living here, you know? And I would say, absolutely not. There's no evidence whatsoever that that's happening. And when I said that, I felt sane. I felt like I was a sane person now. And I was not crazy like everybody thought I was, particularly at Temple University. And so I got to say that. But now I can't say that. That has been stripped out from under me. Now I have to say, yes, they are walking among us, unfortunately, and because that's where the evidence led me, kicking and screaming. And
well, this Eric story is an excellent example of that.
Yeah, Eric was this guy who was, you know, had these long talks about not coming to see me a few blocks away from where I live.
Huh.
Which I didn't put in the book, I don't think.
Yeah. Do you think it was his idea?
No. Although I must say that he suddenly stopped coming and never contacted me again. Well, he did contact me once. He came to after he stopped having sessions with me, he never contacted me again, and I wrote him a bunch of emails, and he never answered his emails. So I think Eric got to him.
Yeah.
And eventually, and that's happened to several people. One time I was doing a sessions with a guy who eventually got his PhD in mathematics. And a good guy, had 10 sessions with him. In the 10th session, he was laying down, and I was asking his questions, and suddenly he sat bolt upright. And he said, "I'm not supposed to be telling you this." And he just turned around, sat down. He wasn't laying down anymore. And he said, "I'm not going to do this anymore." And I, okay, you know, I don't charge any money for what I do. And anybody can come as many times as they want. It's up to them. It's not my life. It's their lives, you know. And so that was it for him. They got to him.
Hmm.
And this happens every once in a while.
So they are, in fact, interfering with the process of the abductee remembering the experience and getting that piece of their life back. But they're also interfering with your work of trying to find a pattern in all this. They don't seem to like that.
They do not like that. That will be my last book. What happened to me when they couldn't stand it any longer?
Right. And this is probably the perfect time to ask you that in all of this research, have you faced any dangerous situations?
Nothing physically happened to me, but I had a series of conversations with one of them, Jamie.
Yes.
And these series of conversations, I had 8 conversations, sometimes lasting us on instant messaging and email.
Yeah. So they're keeping a respectable distance there.
Thank God for that.
Uh-huh.
And I had 8 conversations, sometimes lasting for 4 hours, starting at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Each conversation was sort of astonishing. And that will make up the core of a book. Now, I cannot tell whether or not it was a hoax or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know who was typing these things out. I wasn't there. Betsy lived 135 miles away from me. And she now lives in another state. And maybe she was hoaxing me. She was typing everything out herself. I can't tell. I cannot prove it. However, I'm still in contact with Betsy. I've known her since 1999.
So she doesn't strike you as the kind of person to pull a hoax after 20 years.
No. So, I even had her take a lie detector test.
Wow.
And she was more than happy to do it. Didn't bother her at all. She wanted
to. And the results were.
What's that?
And the results were.
She was not deceptive.
That's so intriguing.
She took that chance, and the results were not deceptive. She was.
So what was the thrust of the interaction with this person interfering in your sessions with her?
It was a security hybrid. And he was the. the situation was such, and this is a story that I have never told before, I don't think, but the situation is such that he would come to her while she was talking to me. It's a longer story than that. She used to come down to my house, 135 miles, for sessions. And then I would have abductee get-togethers, and she'd come down to my house for sessions. Her family did not like that because it meant she'd be gone all day long. And then the husband, it was a weekend usually, the husband had to take care of their kids, and he didn't like that and this and that. She wasn't around. So it was a stress for the family for to have her do that. Then one day, her husband, they tried to pressure her to a fantastic degree to stop coming down and spilling the beans to me, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'm skipping some parts here, but eventually her husband decided that she actually should come down real quickly. Hey, that was all fine with him. That was great. That was wonderful. Yeah, he should come down. She should come down immediately. And I knew at that point that she could never come here again, and so did she. Because the aliens had gotten to her husband to tell her that. There's a backstory there, too, which I'm not going into. And they wanted to follow her down and find out where I lived.
Ah.
And then they could stop me themselves.
Right.
It was the last time I ever saw her. And it was the one beforehand. So we started doing sessions through the phone, of all things. I have done sessions with the phone before. It's not as good. But sometimes when a person lives 1,000 miles away, and this is pre-Skype days.
Right.
Then they found out that I was still talking to her. They put a stop to that. So then I started doing sessions with her on instant messaging, of all damn things in the world.
How did she do it?
Well, she had done so many sessions, she could just put herself into her own sort of world and look at my questions and then answer them and type them out and then close her eyes again. And then she'd look at my questions and it worked.
Yeah.
So then they found out she was doing that.
Uh-oh.
So they wanted her to write me a letter, an email, saying that, "David, everything I have told you has not been the truth. I am sorry. Goodbye." She never called me David in her life. It's always Dave. I looked at that message, and the hairs in the back of my head went up, you know.
Yeah.
Good God. And so we did a session on that.
And?
It was a security hybrid who was next to her, who ordered her to say that. So she did. The next night, I was talking with her, and she sent me another letter, another email. And the email was very bizarre, really bizarre, and relatively long, too. And she's saying this, that. And then suddenly, she forgot to say this, that, and she just said something to the point of, this is not what she said, but she said, "If you do not stop, she will be harmed."
Who was it?
It was this guy, this security guy who was talking to me. And I said, "I don't want to see her hurt or harmed in any way." You know, and suddenly this conversation took. And then I had a series of conversations with him. Believe me. One track mind. Then things escalated. And finally, I had a very large powwow with Jamie. and others, and which led to these other discussions and a resolution of the problem, according to them, which was not a resolution of the problem, and they were still after me. And it's worthy of a book. Worthy of a book. It's extremely interesting. It'll be my only actually interesting book that I write.
But these were pretty menacing encounters, with the message basically being, stop it or else.
Well,
it must have been pretty disturbing.
Right. The security guy wanted to know, who else have you told about this? Who's with you? Is there anybody with you now? Who else is in your house? Things like that. That's all he could talk about. That was it.
Huh.
It was nothing else in his mind. He was single-minded. Very scary.
Yeah.
Very scary. How do we get to your house? You know, it's not exactly like that, but close.
Yeah. Well, you're like, well, I'm not going to send you Google directions or anything.
Right, yeah. Apparently, I'm not sure, but street numbers and street signs may not mean a whole lot to them. They find people in other ways, like following her, being in the car with her as she would drive down. That's how they would find me, you know. Mm-hmm. Or anybody else in that situation.
Wow, these experiences, you know, getting really up close with these security hybrids and not being an abductee is pretty unique. It's actually a very rare experience. How do you reflect on it yourself now, having gone through it? What do you take away from these unusual encounters?
I do know one thing. I think that I am the only person on Earth, I think I'm the only person on Earth who ever talked with a hybrid and knew, unless it was a hoax, and knew it was a hybrid and could ask questions.
Interesting.
Because most people who encounter a hybrid think, oh, this is a very nice person. I won't ask anything of him.
Right.
And then go on their merry way. So I think I'm the only person that's ever had that experience. I may be wrong, but...
So you were pressing the issue with the actual hybrid.
Later on, not the security one.
Okay.
But Jamie.
Right. Now, can you tell us a little bit about Jamie?
Well, Jamie is in the book, and Jamie is a guy who Betsy helped when he moved into his apartment, and this happens all the time with a lot of people, who he moved into his apartment. And he had to learn how to put the furniture in certain places because he had been in people's apartments before. But when it comes to furnishing your own apartment, you have to learn how to do that. And she taught him. And she taught him how to go shopping and how to push a cart.
Uh-huh.
And how to cook things and how to look normal, in other words.
How to act like a normal human being.
To act like a normal human being. Now, this is much more complicated. The problem with hybrids is they are taught what humanity is like. They are taught what being a human is like from the time that they are kids on board a UFO. In other words, one of the things that I put in one of my books was a woman standing in front of a bunch of like 8-year-olds or 10-year-olds. And there's an image on the wall of a UFO, in the UFO, and it's of a dog. And kids ask her, what's a dog for? And she says, well, it's for companionship and love, and people like to play with dogs, and they like dogs. Do you eat dogs? No, people don't eat dogs. People don't know. Somewhere in China, they do eat dogs, I know that. But she said they don't eat dogs. So... then she said, and then there's another picture. It's a goat. What are goats for? The kids ask. Well, you can get milk from them and you make cheese from the milk, you know, and it's all that. Do you eat goats? She said, no, I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat goats. But other people do eat goats, yes. And that's the kind of, they're learning about dogs and goats. They can learn about other things too. And by the time they come here, they've learned a tremendous amount about how to live on Earth. Maybe 1/2 of 1%.
All right.
Everything else how to walk on a sidewalk, how to do this, how to do that. They have to learn by somebody helping them. And it's like, if somebody says something to you like, hey, how you doing? You just can't stand there and stare at them. You have to respond in some way, you know. And
so in terms of mannerisms and everything, they just have to be taught how to fit in. They have to fit in.
You have to fit in, and you can't be weird. And so you just an idle talk with a stranger, you have to be able to know what you how to speak, what to say. And that is the stuff that humans learn just through observation. And I put some things in the book, you know, like what an ice cube is. Or how to use a spoon, you know, things like that. They have to learn all this stuff, and there is no observation. Now, having said that, some kids, age 10 or so, would come into Betsy's living room in the daytime. She worked at home, her kids were at school, and her husband was at work. So they would come in, and she would give them a tour of the kitchen or give them a tour of a bedroom or something like that. And they would learn that. And that would be their first contact with a kitchen. One of the things I put in one of these odd things, she showed this 10-year-old kid a kitchen, and he wanted to know what these were. And she said, well, this is a drawer. And she pulled out the drawer, and he was fascinated by the runners in the side of the drawer. That's what really interested him. And things like that. Kids don't have to be taught that. And they'll just see that through normal growing up, and they know exactly how it works, and they know what an ice cube is, and they know what meat is, and all the rest of that stuff. You don't have to teach them this. They just know.
So these are hybrid children that she's training here.
These are children who are 10 years old. But by the time they get to be older and actually live here, they still need a tremendous amount of teaching and guidance. They are tremendously good learners. They remember everything.
That is very interesting. Now, I'm a little curious about the process here. When someone who's an abductee is training one of these hybrids, you know, is this a lifelong commitment, or do they let them go at a certain point? How does that all work?
Eventually, what happens with abductees is they take these hybrids on, or hubrids, as I call them, because they're living here, and then they teach them as much as the hubrids want, and then the hubrids go away, and a new one comes along. And then they teach them as much as they can, then they go away, and a new one comes along. And that's what they're doing now, apparently. There's a Jamie 2, and then there's a Jamie 3, and so forth.
Do we know what became of that first Jamie?
No. No knowledge. Gone.
Huh.
Don't know. Because of the scare that I had in my life, when it came time that Jamie left, Betsy stopped doing sessions with me. She lives in guilt. She feels she brought this down upon me.
Ah.
And I must say it was extremely frightening. It was extremely frightening. Knowing every day that they might find out where I lived and come here and try to control me, you know. But as far as I know, that never happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, it will make a very interesting story. I'm leaving a large amount out. And
somehow it's not comforting to know that we're just scratching the surface. Okay, this story gets a whole lot more mysterious. And when we come back, we'll have you really tell us, based on your experience, how the alien abduction syndrome is growing up. You know, the days of missing time and flashbacks seem almost innocent compared to this hybrid program. Last round here with Dr. David Jacobs, part 2. It's getting even more interesting. Stay with us.
Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Subscribe now and you'll have access to the complete audio archives to download or stream at your convenience. Receive advanced updates and discounts on Dark Journalist events. Enjoy exclusive subscriber-only content. Go deeper with Dark Journalist. Visit darkjournalist.com and subscribe now for a special summer discount available for just $39 for one full year. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
A As they were sitting there filming, a little saucer came from, I say little saucer, it was a saucer, came flying over their heads, put down three little landing gear and landed right out on the dry lake bed. And they picked up their cameras and started over toward it, filming as they went. And when they got in fairly close to it, it lifted up, put the gear back in the wheel wells, tipped up, and took off at a great rate of speed.
Dark journalist will go there.
But what would an average person's life look like after encountering alien visitors?
Hidden technology.
So in other words, the possibility exists that you have here a machine that is manipulating magnetic fields on a planetary scale that has nothing to do with particle physics.
The black budget.
But there's no such thing as getting away from the corruption because it is literally... It is now integrated into every economy in the globe.
Geoengineering.
I'm talking about right down to the DNA level. Imagine that you have now put microprocessors and sensors, along with everything else, into every human body.
For more deep interviews, special reports, and documentaries, visit darkjournalist.com today. Dark Journalist, the truth is never easy.
And we are back. This is Dark Journalist, and I'm speaking with Dr. David Jacobs, professor at Temple University in Philadelphia. Now, Dr. Jacobs has been right in the heart and on the front lines of understanding the extraterrestrial mystery. His latest book, which is absolutely fascinating, is Walking Among Us, The Alien Plan to Control Humanity. Not a very subtle title there. He's introducing his new research and experiences dealing with hybrids, and we're really on the verge here, I feel, of learning something new about a whole different wave of alien activity going on right now. Now, David, when you look at your many decades involved in the UFO field, and you think back to some of the early abductee cases, it seems like there was a great emphasis on human reproductive testing and what they were harvesting this material for. How has the experience changed?
It's still about that. There's no such thing as testing, but it's all about sperm and eggs and doing other procedures.
Okay.
Testing is really a misnomer. It is something that I thought... all the way through writing my first book, Secret Life, all the way through to the end. I thought they were testing us in some way, examining us, learning things about us, you know. That is not correct. That's wrong. They know everything they need to know about us, and they knew it from a long time ago. Oh. So what exactly is going on with all these technology that they use when people are lying on a table? We have no knowledge of.
Right. So we're at a complete disadvantage because they're certainly not going to divulge their operations to us. But what do the abductees have to say about the procedures and the technology that's being used on them? Is any of that useful?
Everybody says the same thing, et cetera, et cetera. And if you ask people, well, what does this machine do? If they tell you what it does, they are confabulating. Nobody knows what the technology does. We have not been able to uncover what all these procedures that we've been looking at for decades, what these things do. We do know what an instrument used to put an implant in a person's pituitary gland. We do know what an instrument looks like to take out a baby. And we know that from a woman, for people who don't know, eggs are taken, sperm is taken, the eggs and the sperm are put together, maybe not from the two people who are on board together or whatever, but from different people. And then the fertilized egg is altered in some way with maybe alien DNA. We have absolutely no idea whatsoever whether aliens have DNA or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I will just say that whatever the alter is takes place that way, and then an embryo is placed into the woman, and the fetus is removed in about 10, 11 weeks or 12 weeks. Then they're placed; those fetuses are placed in gestation tanks with liquid nutrients, and they absorb their nutrients through that liquid, and then they are removed. which means, incidentally, that they don't know how old they are.
Hmm.
There's no knowledge of their age because they don't have birthdays, they don't have birthday parties, they don't have balloons, they don't have presents, birthday cake, they don't have anything like that. They don't know how old.
But this is how you make hybrids.
These are how you make hybrids. And of course there's a spectrum of hybrids from really looking quite alien to looking absolutely human, you know.
Uh-huh. Yes. I actually made a note about this, which is you say that although identical to humans, there are noticeable differences.
Yes. Well, with early stage hybrids, as I call them, which I label them in my earlier book, The Threat, they look weird. They look half human and half gray alien. They don't look human and half insect-like one, or human and half reptilian-like one. They look half gray aliens. So obviously there's something in them from the gray aliens' DNA, if I can use that word. Their eyes might be really black and really large, but there are whites in the eyes. They have hair. Gray aliens don't have hair, but it's really thin and wispy.
Huh.
They might have, they just look weird. They act weird. They think weird. The middle stage looks sort of like half and half. Eyes are too large, but there's more whites. Hair is still thinnish, but sort of normal, more normal-like. Maybe no body hair. And so forth. Late stage hybrids look quite human, still weird, a little bit weird. Maybe the eyes are still a little too large. Maybe there's something else wrong. It's they're humanoid. They're pretty good. They're pretty close. Not you know, it's no cigar yet, but pretty close. Then there's a human stage who look human. Security hybrids are oftentimes like this. Personal project hybrids are oftentimes like this, but mainly security hybrids. And then there's the hybrids. These are, the difference between the security hybrids and the ones who are really, really human-like is that they have one-track minds. They do, they're not bred to live here. They are bred to live on board a UFO most of the time. When you get to hybrids, they're bred to live here. And they have minds that are exactly like ours, except for the abilities to control us. Everything else is, well, I shouldn't say exactly. Their brains are not fully formed. For example, they don't know what humor is.
Mm-hmm.
When you grow up, when you're a baby, you laugh. People are doing funny things to you to make you laugh from the get-go. And you know how to laugh. And when you get older, you laugh because people are saying funny things. And you know what humor is. And humor is built in to most people. Some people have no sense of humor whatsoever, you know. But
that's definitely true.
But basically, hybrids, even the ones who are living here, have to learn what humor is and learn why it's humorous and things like that, that the kids never ask, because humor never comes up when you're a 10-year-old sitting asking what a dog is, you know what I mean? You don't see, humor isn't there really. Although sometimes the older kids will laugh, I must say. But in terms of the subtleties of language, like, I've made you laugh several times by saying stupid things, like now. That they're not going to get.
Uh-huh.
It's going to go right past them. So they have to learn that. And Abda and Jamie was trying to learn that. Told me he was trying to learn. And but they've never encountered anything like that before. You know, it's not just language. It's language that has subtleties to it that they have never heard before. It's not just subtleties. It's the way in which people talk. Like that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Using a space between each word for emphasis. That's going to go right past them. They never heard that before. You know, they don't know that's supposed to be solemnly important.
Right.
So it takes a lot for them to blend into the society and not draw suspicion on themselves. However, if they do draw suspicion and somebody comes over and says, "Hey, what's the matter with you, buddy?" That person can be controlled real quickly and all that, you know, and they can control us and we can't control them. And
they have this incredible telepathic ability, which makes it really easy to control us.
Without that, we'd be happy campers.
It's a little disquieting.
Their ability to control us telepathically is unbelievably strong. And all communication aboard a UFO, even with hybrids, is done with telepathically. Every once in a while, abductees will say something to a hybrid who will answer non-telepathically on board. But by and large, it's even with hybrids. But to hear somebody talking out loud on board a UFO, to have other people there, it's so odd. It's so weird. It usually only comes in the case of somebody shouting on board a UFO or yelling, like that's what they hear. And the person, something is happening to them and they can't control their automatic reaction of the voice coming out of their throat. But otherwise, it's just plain quiet there. Now, it's not that quiet because people are walking around. So you can hear people walking around. And there's instruments clanking and doing this and that. And people are hustling and bustling. So that's what they hear. But otherwise, they don't hear vocal sounds. You know, that telepathy means a tremendous amount in terms of how they think. There's no such thing as lying. You can't lie if you're holding something back. Somebody might be able to access that.
Right.
There's no humor if you speak telepathically. There's no subtlety of speech in telepathic thoughts. They're just coming in, and you're so. Therefore, hybrids are amazingly innocent because they've never heard anybody lie to them before.
Yeah.
They just take it as truth. And if they find out it's wrong, they get angry. They realize they told them an untruth.
Right.
But their first thought is to think, okay, yes, you'll never do this again. You know, she said they'll never do this again, and they do, you know, and it was a lie. And I wrote an article once about living in a telepathic society, and I also put it in one of my books, The Threat or Secret Life, whatever it was, what it's like to live in a telepathic society. It's not our society. It's not a society you would ever want to live in. But for them to come from a telepathic society at age 18 or 20 and not be telepathic with an abductee in her house or his house or whatever it is a huge, huge learning process. But they are really good at learning, so it doesn't take them very long. They get it. They're not going to be the life of the party. I'll say that. But they're going to be average.
Yeah, that is intriguing. Okay, here's a tough question. The subtitle of the book is The Alien Plan to Control Humanity. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that's the press's subtitle.
Powerful statement there.
But I didn't object because I do think that that is what's going to happen.
Okay.
Their first title was The E.T. Menace.
Well, there you go.
I said, no, I don't think so.
I actually like this subtitle in many ways. It actually captures what you've been after in your efforts in this research for so long. It's somehow appropriate.
There's no way that I could have a title that wasn't sensational in some way or another. You know?
Yes. True. Well, what do you think that they're doing here?
I do think that this is and I've coined a phrase here, and I didn't realize I was doing it, but it is planetary acquisition. Because there is no such thing as planetary acquisition in our lives. It's not a concept. But I think for them, it's not only a concept, but it is a routine phenomenon. And
so they've done it before.
I think that they have done it before. We cannot possibly be the first ones ever to have this happen. In this last chapter that I have there, I go through all the arguments pro and con for these things, or at least con. And there's no possibility that we could be the very first planet in the universe that has ever been hybridized. I don't think so. I point out there all the reasons why this could not possibly be the first time. And so I think it's a routine phenomenon. And I think it's happening to us. And you got to remember, this is a global phenomenon. It's global. It's around the world. The amount of time and energy and effort put into this phenomenon is mind-boggling. It's absolutely phenomenal. The mind cannot grasp how many beings and how much energy has been put into this since the 1920s, let's just say. Since the 1930s. I talked with two abductees who were children in the 1930s, and their events started then, and we looked at those events in the 1930s. The 40s, we got tons of reports from the 40s, and of course, obviously from the 50s. The first abduction event we ever found was 1957 in Brazil, you know, giving it that global phenomenon or aspect almost immediately.
And that is Vias Boas.
Antonio Vias Boas, right.
Yes.
Or Vilas. You know, he speaks Portuguese, although we all pronounce it as Spanish. And the interesting thing about that, the Antonio Vias Boas case, it was October 1957, and he was an illiterate Brazilian peasant who was out farming the land late at night because it was cooler at night. And down came flying saucer from outer space. These aliens got out, grabbed him, pulled him in, and they did this to him and that to him and this to him and that to him. And then they took him into a room where this sort of human-looking alien was, and he was forced to have sex with this woman over and over again. He hated it. It was disgusting. It was horrible, but he couldn't help it because it was kind of good, and so forth and so on.
Okay.
When that story came out, the puritanical UFO researchers absolutely refused to believe it happened, and the sexual content in it, it didn't come out until like 1966 in general knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an illiterate Brazilian peasant. It wasn't until the 1980s that we learned he wasn't an illiterate Brazilian peasant. He was a law student who was home from school. He became an attorney. He maintained the truthfulness of his story all the way to the end.
Well, the Vias Boas story is very fascinating, and there's a lot of details there. Of course, he did become a high court judge. And also, a Brazilian ufologist did some research around the ranch where this all happened. And he found out that it had a lot of the attributes of the Skinwalker Ranch. You know, there were poltergeists seen there for years. There were lights in the hills that Vias Boas' family saw for years before he even had the incident. And apparently there were some kind of shamanistic Indians that were there a couple of centuries before who had been wiped out. So you had all these strange factors going into this sighting. And then, you know, he has this incredible encounter.
The fact is that he never changed his story. Now, he only told little snippets of his story, really. He said at the end they gave him a tour, wrong. And the answer is, no, that's not a concept. Everybody a tour. he must have walked through the ship and looked in different rooms as he was going down a hallway, and he called that a tour. That's what happens to people. That's confabulation.
Yes, but we should say that these early cases are just fascinating.
Well, they're fascinating for what we don't know more than anything, because otherwise they're routine.
Yeah, it's the hidden details that come out years later that are really compelling. And I think of the Betty and Barney Hill case, which has a whole other aspect to it. And you mentioned that there was a sexual component to that one also, although it wasn't reported at the time.
Barney was so embarrassed by the firm that by the fact that sperm was taken from him, that when John Fuller wrote his book called Interrupted Journey about the Barney and Betty Hill case, he had Fuller take that part out of the book.
Right.
It was just too embarrassing. With Betty Hill, they stuck a needle in her navel, and she said later that he had told her, the guy who did this, that it was a pregnancy test. No. We know this procedure. I have many, 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 many cases of a needle in the navel. It's not a pregnancy test. It's probably that the needle is angled in such a way, and I don't know why they do it to the navel, it goes into the ovary and takes eggs out.
Huh.
And it is not a pregnancy test. There's no concept of a pregnancy test. That is confabulation.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, if all communication is telepathic on board, what is to prevent an abductee from hearing their own thoughts and thinking that they're coming from the outside in? The answer is, nothing prevents that. They do it all the time.
Yeah.
So, in other words, everything, even the errors, are logical about this phenomenon. Even the errors.
Yes. Well, it's certainly operating on a totally different level of efficiency. Now, for the casual observer of the abduction phenomena and UFOs, what do you think are the kind of easy to overlook aspects that are missed here?
It's an astonishing phenomenon, and it's global. Like I keep saying, nothing like this has ever happened in human history. I can say that with absolute assurance. There's never been anything like this. Never, ever, ever, ever. People around the world describing the same instruments, the same events. People who don't know that they're abductees.
Yeah, it's really hard to fathom. And you've been right there on the front lines observing it up close. And I guess that really brings me to my last question for you. And it's been really excellent having you here. What I'd like to know is, since you started and you've gone through these major developments in the UFO field, from Bud Hopkins' work, and then Professor John Mack came on the scene, and Whitley Strieber's Communion came out before that. And then your own deep research came out on the scene, and people really got to know a very different angle from the way that you were looking at these things. How does it feel now in terms of public awareness around the UFO topic and the progress that's been made? You know, do you think that we haven't really developed a good understanding of what's going on here? Or are things progressing well, and we're really learning a lot?
Number one, the problem here is the abduction phenomenon has come to be just another item in popular culture. I have cable TV, I got the whole works, I've got 8 million channels. They have to fill up their programming with something. A lot of them go to UFOs, abductions. Then they go to ghosts, then they go to spirit things, then they go to reincarnation. I don't know what they do. They go from one item to another, and it looks like it's just part of this sort of mental phenomenon that's going on that's in popular culture. Whereas in this phenomenon, people see other people being abducted and are not abducted themselves, and they can point out that, well, there was this UFO over your house. I saw somebody fly into the, Bud Hopkins wrote a book about one of these cases where people see, the Linda Cortile case, witnessed, where people saw her being abducted. And
was that the UN one where they took her out of the window in New York?
Yeah, took her out of her apartment in New York. Excuse me. People, all the traffic stopped on the Brooklyn Bridge. One woman saw Bud Hopkins missing time and got in touch with, or intruders, and got in touch with him when she saw his book in a bookstore. So he was only able to interview one person who was actually on the Brooklyn Bridge in her car. And the thing she said was, she first obviously was watching a Hollywood movie, but then she said that She could hear people in the car behind her screaming.
Wow.
And but that it's an error. I think Bud put more emphasis on different aspects of it, but I think it's just an error. She shouldn't have been seen.
Yeah.
But that is evidence. And if that's not happening, I mean, the mind does boggle if you keep saying it's not happening and not happening, and you've got all this other evidence about people seeing other people. I've got other cases like that too, and oftentimes they're family members who see their mother or their father going out that window, you know, whatever, or vice versa. The kids go.
Oh, yeah.
So if that's not happening, it's the most important thing we've ever uncovered that has to do with how the brain works. But the fact is, though, that it becomes just another part of popular culture.
So it's making it more of a superficial thing now, like a novelty. But you represent a wave of investigation from professionals and academics. Now I realize that people like you and Mac were the exceptions to the rule, definitely. But why haven't we seen a new wave of investigation from a kind of young, emerging group of researchers?
You can't get a 21-year-old kid and teach him how to do hypnosis with abductees. It's not going to happen. You don't want that. You get a 50-year-old woman, she's not going to spill her guts about all the sexual events that happened to her and taking eggs and this and that and getting sperm from guys. Not going to happen.
Right.
So you got to go with somebody who's in their 40s, let's just say. Well, in your 40s, you got a spouse, you got kids, you got a career, you got a job, you know, it's not going to happen. So the amount of people who are interested in this subject has declined, I think, in terms of people who do the work, has declined tremendously. It used to be that there was tons of people who were interested in it, mostly UFO researchers. And now even UFO researchers, I'm old. I came up with a group of people, Ron Westrum, a retired professor of sociology at Eastern Michigan, Jerry Clark, who wrote a UFO encyclopedia and many other books about the subject, and Bruce McAbee is a retired PhD who worked for the government for many years, who does photographic analysis and all that. We're all around the same age. There's nobody who's been taking our place, you know, and so I don't feel confident about the future and our knowledge of the subject, because it doesn't matter how many people are interested in the subject. What matters the most is people who have pull, people who are scientists, who have PhDs and all that sort of stuff. I hate to say it because it sounds elitist, but they're the ones who can maybe contact other scientists about, well, wait a second, we better take another look at this, you know, things like that. And without the scientific and academic community taking this seriously, I just don't see this phenomenon, you know, doing much more than it's been done since we've known about UFOs since 1947. You know, there's been a retreat from it. In 2002, I gave a paper for a Mutual UFO Network symposium. This is their national symposium. And it was called How to Build the Scientific Community or whatever. And the first thing I did is I went back to every document I could find that had a listing of people who had lent their names publicly to these UFO organizations, starting with the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon and the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization and the Mutual UFO Network and whatever other ones I could find, who had lent their names to publicly used and who had advanced degrees. And there were something like 1,200 people had lent their names to these organizations over the years, who had advanced degrees, who were scientists and academics themselves oftentimes. Now, there are no more listings of consultants, as they called them, or people who had lent their name. You don't find that anymore.
Huh.
The academic community has no interest in this subject at all.
Hmm.
There's a few academics here and there, maybe. but not in the numbers that we need.
Are you shocked by the lack of progress that we've made on the subject of alien abduction as a culture?
No, I'm not shocked at all. It's very difficult work. It takes a tremendous amount of time. Every time somebody steps into my house, it costs me $100 just for the transcript. And then other stuff I had to buy and this and that. And you know, it was what I call a negative cash flow business.
Yes.
And so, but when money changes hands, only bad things can happen.
Absolutely.
So nobody ever paid. Anybody could come as many times as they want, stop whenever they wanted. That was fine. As I said, it's their lives. I would hope that much more people would do this, and that maybe this little thing, How to Do Hypnosis with Abductees, that I'm going to write, will help that.
Definitely, no question. And I really want to congratulate you for your perseverance, and your latest book is a real eye-opener. It's an amazing read, and it really includes a new approach on these hybrid cases. Outstanding. And I think the fact that you focused on just these 14 cases really gives it a consistency of watching these kind of bizarre encounters unfold.
There were more people in my other books, but I thought Bud Hopkins used 7 abductees in his book Missing Time, which was extremely influential. So I figured 14 will be enough.
Well, twice as many, that should right. Do it. It's an amazing book. And where can we get the book?
You can get it at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. It's not a press like Simon & Schuster who will get it into every bookstore in the nation. But Barnes & Noble does carry it in their bricks and mortar stores from time to time as well.
Fantastic. David, thank you. And we'll all be following your mind-bending research into this murky and crucial mystery of alien abduction. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining me for this fascinating episode with Dr. David Jacobs on the UFO threat and hybrid infiltration. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries at www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.
Coming up next week for subscribers, a rare in-depth interview with physicist and remote viewing pioneer Russell Targ. Don't miss it.